إذا زلزلت الأرض زلزالها وأخرجت الأرض أثقالها وقال الإنسان ما لها يومئذ تحدث أخبارها بأن ربك أوحى لها يومئذ يصدر الناس أشتاتا ليروا أعمالهم فمن يعمل مثقال ذرة خيرا يره ومن يعمل مثقال ذرة شرا يره صدق الله العظيم. أعوذ بالله.
Okay, so you explained that this isn't really considered music or anything like that, poetry. It's just teaching for the Quran. Would you mind explaining the context? Yeah, where would you hear it? Who would do it, etc.?
Sure. In the Quran, which has about 114 chapters, the last 20 or 30 of the chapters tend to be very short. They're almost each like a hymn in some ways, and they all rhyme. Many of the lines rhyme, which makes it much easier for people to memorize them. And then for the daily prayers, the five times a day prayers that people would do, they would pick two of the chapters of the Quran to repeat, and people can choose the two that tend to correspond to how they're feeling on that day or their spiritual state. And so, you know, this kind of musical recitation is something that one would tend to see at a daily level. You can also see it in a public level at mosques where Quran reciters would be performing recitation. Yes, of the 114 chapters of the Quran, 113 of them start with this line of Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Bismillah simply means in the name of God. And then we're introduced to two of the divine qualities, ar-Rahman and ar-Rahim, the compassionate and the merciful. And part of the idea here becomes that one thinks of the divine as not just this distant being, but really as the perfection, as the completion of these beautiful qualities. And so part of the seeker, the one who's on the spiritual path, is to recognize and awaken and attempt to embody these kinds of qualities. And so what would it be to live a life where every breath, every moment, every glance, every word, every touch is lived with this awareness of divine qualities of compassion and mercy.
Do you have any more questions? Even though I'm still like that, isn't it? Can you mind giving me a little bit of introductory background on this while I set it up?
Sure. So what we're going to be listening to here is a track that's actually produced by Cat Stevens, now known more commonly as Yusuf Islam. And it's going to be a simple set of blessings sent upon the Prophet Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin Mustafa. Allahumma salli Muhammadin
Would you mind giving me a little bit of information about that? It's from the life of the Prophet. Is that recited like the Quran we heard the first time? Or,
Right. So, you know, oftentimes when people would go to prayers in mosque settings and what have you, after the formal prayers are done, there's always a section during which people would send greetings and blessings upon the prophets. And it's very common to send those blessings on a number of prophets. And, of course, there is a section that is reserved for Muhammad himself. And in a mosque setting, one would hear this kind of, again, musical chanting and blessings that is being done. It would not be considered any kind of a problem to have a frame drum accompany them. And the distinction between this kind of music and what we're going to hear primarily from this point on is that it's when stringed instruments become introduced that they tend not to be performed in a mosque setting, but they tend to be performed in shrine settings or Sufi gatherings or, you know, other kinds of get-togethers. Good question. I think the assumption is that we know that during the lifetime of the Prophet himself, that people would sing songs and they would bang on drums during the singing of that song. So for people who want to feel like we are not exceeding any bounds that Muhammad himself would have set, they would tend to stick to those particular instruments. As for stringed instruments, they're found in virtually every single part of the world where Muslims live. But the question becomes, to what extent do they become incorporated into religious spaces, such as a mosque?
Actually, I want to ask you a question about that, because when I was listening really closely, it sounded like there was some low drone sound in the mix. Was that just a voice, or was it just a drum, or am I just hearing things?
You must have better ears than I do then. I do know that there was a congregation basically responding, and in this, one of the things that we heard in this one was that, you know, there was the main vocalist who starts the chant, and then there are people who respond, and there's multiple voices there. Maybe that was one of the things you were picking up on. One of the things that I like about this track is that there's a little boy who's also featured very much in there. And in some of the other Sufi songs that we'll listen to hopefully today, there are women who also become part of the congregational gathering that one would hear. And so the idea becomes that we have now gone from a model where there's a performer and a vocalist to a sort of communal gathering where we're supposed to be hearing a plurality of voices.
It's interesting you mentioned about women in the congregation, because the first track you listened to was also by women.
Right.
What role do women play in this tradition?
Well, that really varies from culture to culture. Even let's take something like women reciting the Quran. In many Arab cultures, it would be highly unusual to have women reciting the Quran publicly in a mosque setting or elsewhere. They would do so in a mosque setting, sort of in a lower voice, so that they alone can hear it. On the other hand, you go to a place like Malaysia and Indonesia, and there are Quran recitation competitions which are held in soccer stadiums for men and for women. So something that in one part of the world is really kind of risque, in another part of the world is absolutely considered a part of the practice.
Well, let's move on to the next song.
Sure.
Can you give a brief introduction?
Sure. So the track that we're going to listen to here is a poem from the 10th century. It is the work of a Persian mystic named Hallaj, who wrote all of his poetry in Arabic. And this is an ecstatic poem about the experience that Hallaj has of feeling this intimate sense of union with his beloved, with God. And some of the lyrics that we're going to be hearing is this refrain, Ruhahu Ruhi Waruhi Ruhahu. His spirit is my spirit is his spirit. We can talk more about it after we have
listened to it. Thank you. Of a poem by a poet named Hawad.
Poet and Sufi, yeah.
Would you mind giving a little background information on his wife, by rough translation?
Sure. Hawad is an Iranian Sufi. He is killed in the year 922 for rather complicated set of factors. And he is probably most well known for having uttered this statement in one of these moments of ecstasy, "An al-haq," which means "I am the truth." And that was seen as a particularly problematic statement, since within the Islamic tradition, haq, or truth, is one of the names of God. And so people took him to mean that he was claiming to be God, whereas to his defenders in the Sufi tradition, he had emptied himself of his self, and so the one that was speaking through him was God. And so some of the poets, in fact, people like Rumi and others, have come to say, you know, we have always been told that when God appeared to Moses, that he spoke through a burning bush, and no one seems to find that a problem. Why is it that we are so mortified when God speaks through humanity?
You brought an interesting point, because after the circumstances of his death, I was wondering about the sort of the relationship of Sufism within Islam, as a question of the what do you go over, what's the relationship between general Islam and more specific variety of Sufism?
Right. Well, you know, I think in the modern Islamic tradition, there are certainly many Muslims who've often been told that Sufism is somehow suspect or it is marginal. I think when we look at things from a more historical perspective, this spiritual path, this mystical path, was certainly as common, as popular, and as mainstream in a way as anything that we're likely to find. And in fact, in many places, like Turkey, like Iran, like Senegal, Sub-Saharan Africa, and South Asia, there is no way that one can even disentangle the Islamic traditions in each of these places from the Sufi tradition. There is no Turkish Islam without Turkish Sufism, and so on. So I think it's important to know those things.
I think that, like, I am the truth, it can sound funny to people inside or outside religion, on the Orthodox side or on the Muslim side.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think, you know, what Halaj and poets like him are talking about is essentially their experience. They're not necessarily trying to say that they have become one with God, but they're saying that they feel one. And I think that difference between what you feel like and sort of more, you know, ontological being kind of language is an important thing. When you love someone, you feel like you have become one with them. There's those moments of intense union where you no longer know where you end and they begin. And in Halaj's poetry, this shows up in the very same poem that we listened to. You know, there's a magnificent line where he says, "If the beloved wants to walk on my cheeks, he can." Because there's no longer two wills, there's no longer two desires. Even their willpowers have become united together in that sense. Yeah.
And you've also mentioned the sometimes questionable character of this guy. I think that's an interesting thing to bring up about his life and his context.
Right, exactly. Because, you know, the Sufis, on one hand, they are very much known for their observance of adab, which is a kind of polite, selfless, compassionate etiquette in some ways, of the giving of oneself so that the person that you're with can have more. And then at the same time, they also realize that this kind of a compassionate etiquette, selfless manners and all of that, it can become another idol. So there's always been a tradition of people that in an older age we would have called them rogues, and nowadays we want to call them punks or, you know, countercultures or whatever people. And I think Halaj fits into that tradition, someone that defies the conventions of society, even the Sufi conventions of society. And that has very much been an important recognized part of the spiritual path as well in these traditions.
I just want to ask you about the musical features of what we just heard there. I noticed that the singer's voice tends to be more emotive than exact. more expressive than classical. I was wondering how that fits into this tradition. What the role of emotiveness in proper musical performance is.
Right. Good question. Well, you know, I think one in this kind of performance, and also I should add in Quran recitation as well, you know, there's a sense that one is not just reading a recipe list, that you really are communing with the divine, you're communing with all that is around you, all the people, all of the cosmos, and the sacred. And so you can't do that without opening up your heart and soul. And if you're reading these lines from Hallaj, which begin with this very intense desire and love that he has, he begins by whispering his desire to the morning breeze. And he wants the wind to carry the sound of his love to the farthest distances. And he begins by saying that he has a love that knows of no cure, that every disease is cured through something. The one thing that caused him to feel like this, which is to see the beloved, is the very thing that intensifies his love pain. When you're reading something like that, you can't just read it in a monotonous voice. And so if you get to the point where the burden of pain and agony and yearning and longing and seeking and hopefully finding gets to the point that it cracks the voice, so be it. One sees, by the way, the same thing in Quran recitation. It's not at all unusual in Quran recitations, even in the Kaaba in Mecca, to see the main Quran reciter break down in tears to the point that they're unable to move on and they just have to take some moments to try to regather and recompose themselves and gather themselves before continuing.
We're about to move on to the next track. I just want to let people know that this is a pre-recorded show, but you're right now listening to the Goldie Music Show. Our topic today is music and Sufism, and my guest, Professor Omid Taqi and Janet Hanna Heister. We're going to move on to the next track. If you want to do an introduction for that while I put it in the CD player, please go ahead.
Sure. So what we're going to be listening to now is the music that accompanies one of the sessions of the performances of the Whirling Dervishes, the so-called Whirling Dervishes. The Whirling Dervishes, who tend to be one of the sort of iconic images when people tend to think of Turkey today, are actually a particular Sufi group known as the Mevlaviye or the Mevlaviye. They're followers of Rumi. And what we're going to be listening to here is the playing of the reed flute, the ney, as well as the beating of a drum. And the beating of the drum is supposed to correspond to the beating of the human heart. And as the performance progresses, you might see the beats intensify or slow down, depending on the states that they're trying to awaken in you.
Thank you.
So you explained that this is an instrumental that's supposed to go along to the Dancing with the Dervishes. And it sounds sort of improvised to me. Would you mind explaining the role of improvisation? And whether these tracks are actually written out beforehand or whether they just go along with the dancing?
Sure. Here's one of the differences between getting music like this on a CD and actually participating in the Sufi rituals themselves. When we have a CD, the CD is supposed to be, an hour long, supposed to be in 8 to 10 tracks, and each track is supposed to have a certain number of minutes. A traditional Sufi whirling ceremony might take 3 to 4 hours, and each one of the movements, each one of the tracks, as we tend to think of it, could last anywhere from 30 minutes to 45 minutes. So, yes, there is a kind of modality, there's a framework within which the musicians and the dancers and the teachers are all operating, but then there's also this room for maneuvering, improvising, and that task, that responsibility falls to the spiritual teacher, the sheikh or the peer, and it's part of her task or his task to monitor all the participants and to figure out what kind of state are they in, and based on that, whether to speed up the pace of things or whether to slow it down. And you might see them do this through the clapping of their hands to the beat that they want or to the beating of a certain staff, or even in many settings, just through much more subtle glances that they would exchange with the musicians. And I think that kind of improvisation, which... it reminds some people of jazz, or Hannah, you said it reminds you of jam sessions, right? I think that that's also a lovely way of thinking about it. Is, I think, very much a feature of this tradition.
Something else that I noticed, you were talking about how in modern day Turkey, the whirling dervishes is just sort of a tourist thing,
right?
It's sort of a kick kind of culture. And we also mentioned earlier how a lot of Muslims think of Sufism like a as something not necessarily heretical, but not part of mainstream Muslim culture. I was just wondering if you could explain sort of where Sufism is in the modern Middle East, just really briefly. What does it look like now in countries like Turkey and Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think, Hannah might be spending some years of her life tracing this this topic, so maybe she could have something to say about it.
I think it's too easy for us to try to put things on a scale of heretical to orthodox, whereas the lived religion, the lived spirituality is one that is individual and is changing in every moment that it's experienced. And so, in my sense, it's extremely limited and is limited to Turkey, where the official titles and faces of Sufi groups were outlawed in the 20s. And according to one Sufi teacher, Samama, who I spoke with, she was accepting of this, and she said, yes, the Sufi teachers were gaining too much power bases around themselves, whereas, in her view, it's now much more of a daily spiritual activity. And so, hearing from you, about the different ways that Sufism is experienced throughout the world, it's different in every region. Women will be more included in one space, and music will be more included in another. In the Iranian culture, we, as Americans, we see only the political side of Iran, but in just the short few weeks that I've been in a class with you about the Islamic heritage of Iran, we've seen the poetic and the regal part of the culture where you spoke about a childhood memory of hearing recitations of this poetry over the state radio, which, in our very scaled view of Islam would fall very heretical, but it's the daily lived religion.
And I think it's, you just yet another reminder that there's really no substitute for face-to-face human encounter. And it is best, I think, when we can have this encounter in person, whether it means having it here, having it through travel, through study abroad, through whatever. But in lieu of that, I think, even something like giving oneself over to a great work of fiction that comes from another part of the world, or really opening up one's heart and soul to a piece of music that comes from somewhere else, and to say, this is the passion and the love and the loss that others have experienced, and there's something in this that I too can connect with. I think these are all really important parts of what it means to study human experiences and not just always insist on these labels of this is who we are and this is who they are kind of a thing.
I think it might be worth asking about the ney that we heard, the reed flute that we heard in this piece. You said these are mevlevis,
right.
The whirling dervishes, each different brand of Sufism has their own traditions, and theirs is to whirl, and they are founded by Rumi, what we know as Rumi. Can you tell us about the significance of the ney in his poetry?
Sure. You know, one of the extraordinary metaphors that Rumi came up with was this way of thinking of the human being as being represented by this musical instrument of a flute. And the way that you would get a flute is that you would go to a bed of reeds, a place that these bamboo shoots basically would grow. You would cut one out, hollow it out, and you would press a burning hot piece of metal against it 7 times until it resembled a flute. And so part of what he's talking about is that in our own life too, there is also the experience of pain. There's also the experience of being cut from our origin, and that there are hardships that come along in life. And yet, for him, this pain and this suffering and this exile, really, is not pointless. That there's a way in which music and beauty can emerge through the experience of pain. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, for Rumi's followers, this metaphor of the ney has been such a powerful one, because it connects the Sufi teachings to our own experiences, whether that experience is loss and pain, whether that experience is joy and ecstasy and union, that all of this can be a part of helping us produce beauty and be part of that production.
Well, if you don't mind, if you could go on to the next track and once again, just a brief discussion.
Sure. This track is one of my absolute favorites. It's by a contemporary Turkish musician named Omar Faruk Tekbilek, and I'm excited to listen to him because I'm very hopeful that, inshallah, he will be visiting UNC during the spring semester. This is from a CD called Suleiman the Magnificent, which was one of his first CDs that he did. And then listen to the last track of this CD. What I really love about this one is that the music of this particular track resembles a stage in one's spiritual growth. This track is about 4 or 5 minutes long, and after about 2 minutes, there's a moment in which you hear the instrumental playing peak, pause, go silent for a second, and then all of a sudden a new world opens up. And I think in some ways, at least for me, this is one of the best ways that I've been able to musically experience what the mystics talk about as this sudden burst of illumination. That sometimes to be on a spiritual path is to grind it out. It's to day in and day out, to watch yourself, to monitor yourself, to make sure that your interactions with people is filled with compassion, to be watchful over one's own selfishness, one's own ego-centeredness. And then at some point you get these bursts of light, these flashes that come one way. And this musical piece, after about 2 minutes for me, is a beautiful way of experiencing that.
Thank you.
Alright, so I was hoping maybe you could tell me a little about this artist, about his biography, and what exactly this music comes from.
Sure. The musician is named Omar Faruk Tekbilek, and he has a fascinating life story. He is a Turkish musician and a scholar, actually, who went through more or less the equivalent of a seminary in Turkey. So he's actually qualified to lead prayers. And sometimes in some of his CDs, he has beautiful chantings of the Quran and, sort of very Islamic phrases. And I've seen him do that in live concerts as well. And he ended up moving to the States. And for 17 years, he worked in a factory, basically doing manual labor, and just never gave up on that dream of being able to share this gift of music that he has with people. And I've always found that story just really very touching and moving about him to hang on to these burning dreams that one has, even if it takes 17 years of having to find other ways of making a living. He worked with a musician named Brian Keane, and this was the first of the really great famous CDs that they've done, and they've continued to tour together for a number of years.
And so what instrument does he play? He
plays about 15 instruments. Yeah, okay. He's one of those types that, and in his concert, he just, picks the flute up and plays the flute and puts it down and picks up something else. And if he weren't such a profoundly humble person, it would be very easy for him to be full of himself. But he actually lives the tradition that he sings from. So he... there's this extraordinary way that it's almost as if he's become transparent and the music is just flowing through him. And it's a lovely thing to see.
Do you have a question?
Sure. In Sufism, there's different sects of traditions. Hmm. Do you know to which one he belongs? Or?
I kind of asked him one time, and he very sort of politely said, "What matters is to love." And I figured if he's going to sidestep that issue, then I don't need to push it any further. And I thought that was actually a great reminder, also.
Well, we're sort of running out of time, so I'm going to do the next track.
Sure.
Once again, thank you for the question.
Okay. So the track that we're going to listen to here is from a CD called Ocean of Remembrance. And of course, one of the main components of the Sufi tradition is to live in a perpetual state of mindfulness, in a perpetual state of the remembrance of the friend, the beloved. So what we're going to listen to is a form of zikr, which is this repetition of the divine name. And the phrase is the one that we've already talked about once, called Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, full of compassion, full of mercy. And what we're going to hear is a zikr in the background, and in a couple of minutes we'll hear a vocalist come and sing over that. So combination of zikr and poetry.
All right. You're listening to the Music Show, and WXAC, Chapter Hair.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So this is a band called Tumata.
Tumata.
Yeah,
actually, I thought that Hannah has a great experience with them, having seen them in concert. Maybe she could share.
Well, we were actually lucky enough to be invited to come see them, and it was a very intimate setting because in Turkey, groups like these, the state has a very complicated relationship with religious identity. They like to keep it into specific places that are identified as a religious place, I mean mosques. And so a lot of these Sufi groups have had to rename themselves almost into NGOs and have a function. So this group functions as a traditional music group. And so when we went, we had to climb up like three or four flights of stairs and this main street and tourists everywhere. We had to go past the travel agency, and we get up there, take our shoes off one floor below, and so the room is just full of traditional instruments, and the teacher explained that he had had to look through different manuscripts to find how to make certain of these instruments that hadn't been seen in 500 years, and it was just this incredible, very what we would call hippie almost atmosphere. And so for the first half of their performance, it was very traditional music with bells and animal noises, and then they stopped and they set us a meal, and then they began with the zikr. It's a religious ceremony. In our understanding in America, it would almost be like a church service, but something more intense and more about a connection with God.
No, and I think that's lovely, and this makes a perfect transition, because in a Sufi ceremony, one begins with Quran recitation, which we've already heard. You would begin by blessings on the Prophet, which we've already heard. You would do zikr like this for a long time, and then you would move into the really ecstatic kind of poetry, which is what we're going to get ready to move to right now. And this is a poetry sample from one of the leading vocalists in Iran. He's probably the most popular vocalist in Iran today, a person named Shahram Nazari. He's come actually to the Chapel Hill, Durham area a few times as well. And we're going to listen to the last track, the seventh track on this CD. And this is what happens after you've done your zikr, after you've done your Quran, after you're ready to experience some kind of hardcore unity. We'll let the music tell the story.
Well, actually, I think we're about out of time, so I think we're going to leave this to the last track.
Okay.
We have to. So, Arista, I'd like to thank both of you for being my guest.
Pleasure.
And so, if there's anything you want to add after the track, you can say it now about this one, or anything in general, closing statement, either of you.
For me, I'd just rather have let the poetry say the final words, which is, this is his experience of having been fed an ancient wine, metaphorically understood. He has an ancient intoxication from this beloved that he has had forever. And so at the end of the path, one ends up finding union with the one that you've been with all along. Anyway.
All right, well, thank you so much, and thank you for listening. This is Golden Music Show. We broadcast the last Wednesday of every month. Next month, our guest will be the Center for Global Initiatives, and so stick around to listen to that. This month's guests have been Amit Shafir and Hannah Heisel, and we've been talking about Sufism, basically, but a lot of other things also. I've enjoyed the show a lot, and I hope you have too. If you want to listen to the show later, you can go to our website at AAS Studies, and you can download it there. So thank you for listening. This is WXRC Chapel Hill.
Seventh track.